Our second session entitled Ensemble Creation Between Then and Now, and I'm joined by Claire MacDonald and Chris Good. Claire was one of the founder members of Impact Theatre, which has a connection with our earlier session. Impact was founded in Leeds in the early 80s, or was
late,
it late,
late
70s?
Very late 70s.
Yeah, very late 70s. And so has some kind of overlap with the social and the creative milieu that you've already heard about, and was an outfit that was experimental in terms of its form, and that theatrical form was the result of an ensemble production process. Decisions were made collectively. There wasn't a strong directorial hand, as I understand it, although people had different jobs to do. But decisions were, the group met and made decisions about collectively about which way to go. Today, we might say, Impact Theatre was devised. Although I know you're not particularly happy with that word, Claire, as a description of Impact's process. And we've also got Chris Good from Chris Good and Company, who is the director of the Contemporary Performance Ensemble, Ponyboy Curtis, which some of you may have been lucky enough to see recently in performances at the Yard Theatre in Hackney Wick. So both of our contributors have been involved in ensemble work. It may have ensemble work in theatre may have interesting parallels with what we might wrongly call ensemble work in music production in bands. There may be in for example the discussions that Kevin and Green were talking about that took place, in the rehearsal studio, and the arguments that took place about, that kind of mixing of argument and doing, that kind of poesis, if you like, is as relevant to the production of music as it is to the production of performance and theatre. Just to say, while we're on theatre, that the title of today's session, Collective Creation Between Welfare and Austerity, I shamelessly nicked from theatre scholarship, and there's these two volumes. One's called A History of Collective Creation, the other is Collective Creation in Contemporary Performance, both edited volumes by Catherine Sisayeva and also Scott Proudfit, if you want to chase them up. But just to more fully introduce our contributors, Claire will be speaking first, Claire MacDonald, and she works in the arts and centres on conversation, collaboration and community. She writes and teaches widely and was a co-founder, as I've already mentioned, of the influential visual theatre-making collective Impact Theatre Cooperative in Leeds, whose archive of film and performance is now being reworked by the company, starting with the showing of the film version of The Carrier Frequency, a collaboration with the writer Russell Hoban at Arts Admin in London earlier this year. Her recent book, Utopia, is both a collection of plays and a reflection on the cultural history of her practice. Her recent writing also includes All Together Now, Performance and Collaboration, which is a fantastic essay that I use a lot in my teaching and also in the book I'm writing. And that can be found in Dee Hedden and Jenny Klein's collection called Histories and Practices of Live Art, which was published by Palgrave in 2012. She also writes on poetics, feminist art practice, and the pedagogy of performance writing. She's currently a senior research fellow at Central School of Speech and Drama in London. Claire will be then followed by Chris Good, who is a writer, director, performer, and musician. He has been lead artist of Chris Good and Company since its inception in 2011. He is also director of the performance ensemble, as I've said, Ponyboy Curtis. Recent work for Chris Good and Company includes Wanted, which is at the West Yorkshire Playhouse, Everyone, Battersea Arts Centre, Weaklings, Warwick Arts Centre, Men in the Cities, Royal Court and Traverse, Stand, Oxford Playhouse, Forest in the Field, Oval House, and the Adventures of Wound Man and Shirley, again at Battersea. Chris is the author of The Forest and the Field, Changing Theatre in a Changing World, which was published by Oberon, and he hosts the Chris Good and Company podcast, Thompson's Live. Let's welcome our contributors. Claire, if you please.
I'm going to use this mic because it's a lot easier for me to stand up and talk to you. And Liam is going to run a short piece of a video of a very old show of mine, and we'll see which one it is when it comes up. In fact, it's an absolute privilege to be here, and extraordinary to follow Green, who I didn't know at Leeds, and Kevin, who I knew very well in 76, 77. I'm going to start by just saying a couple of things about that moment in Leeds. A story, if you like. And the story I tell you today will be different from any other story that I might ever tell any of you on any other day, because we are here together, and the people who are here and the things that are said are different from any other time that we might be together now, then, or in future. So in 76, 77, just before that night that Green and Kevin talked about, I met Kevin. We encountered one another in that space just before everything happened. And it happened differently for each of us. My own encounter with Leeds went right back to 71. When I was 16, I left school, I worked in a shop in Leeds, I did one A-level, and eventually, actually rather quickly, I went to university. I went to Leeds because, just as for Green, it was a kind of mecca. It was a big city, it was extraordinary. I'd been told by our art teacher that it was an amazing art school, but I just left school anyway, as many people did then, and then the rest of my life took off after that. But in 76, 77, things really began to shift. They began to shift for many people in profoundly different ways. I just left university, and I was also involved in the food co-op movement. But in 76, 77, I became involved in radical feminism. And that's one of the ways in which our lives began to fork very differently. That was a very different moment in Leeds for women. It was the moment of the Ripper case, which many of you will remember. It was a moment when, for us, the moment of punk was deeply fractured because it represented all kinds of things about anarchic voices in the public media, about a kind of infraction into the very alternative life that we lived, which was actually disruptive and finally, I think, fantastically refreshing, but also very difficult. After that moment, I moved into making a theatre cooperative, and the rest, as they say, is history, and somewhere it will be on there as well. I want to kind of break that moment, if you like, of nostalgic reflection, because I could really talk about it today, but won't. Kevin just said to me earlier in the taxi as we came here that it's like being in a long feedback loop, a kind of systems feedback that seems and yet doesn't quite seem to come back to a similar moment of today. The changing constant, or the constant changing. I've been thinking about it now ever since Gavin invited me into this conversation. What it is to be part of the changing constant, the constant change, as art is always part of. The continuously unfolding horizon of the present. And how does the past figure in that? How does the past continue to resonate in the present? So I'm here today to take part in a conversation with you, who are equally as qualified as I to talk about past, present, then, and now. And I'm here because my own career connects moments of collective, cooperative spirit from the 1980s to the collaborative commons, the movement, the change, the uncertainty, if you like, of the present. To think about how to open up the present to the past usefully, and think about the kinds of tools that we need to do that. As you can see, I'm speaking to you from some roughly scribbled notes. They're evidence of my earlier thinking this week, and yet I've been thinking about this for a very long time, about how we converse, how we speak, what place we speak in, what voices can emerge in that space, what happens in the public square in order to... in order somehow to invoke the possible. It's not easy in some way. What was then is not the then now. What was now then is not the now of then. And it's our job today, in some fantastic way, to be able to ask those places to begin to meet. Whenever I'm thinking about those terms, and I just used several, commons, collective, uncertainty, I think always about Raymond Williams. And most of you will be familiar with his extraordinary work, Keywords. And he began to put together a kind of index of words that were in flux, in continuous change, words that hurt, words that made people feel very uncomfortable, words that were in movement out of their own moment and into something else. And he began that when he was teaching an adult education in the 1950s. And he began it because when he returned to Cambridge after the war and came as a working class student on what I suppose in America would be called the GI Bill, he turned to a friend very famously and said, "But they don't speak our language anymore." So it was in response to his own experience. I wanted to say to you that I feel that I've moved from a moment in which words like proletariat, community, and co-op, gaze, and collective moved through edge, live, risk, and queer, and critical. They moved into the creative industries, into fluidity, into partnership. And as we speak, I think they've come to momentarily rest in local, in movement, in belonging, in transition, transparent, and transform. Let me tell you a story. And it's a story that some of you may have heard before because it happened to me about 10 years ago and it was picked up by Radio 4 and went on to Wireless Nights, which Neil McCarthy edited. But it was a story about something that happened to me when I was still living in America, so it must be before 2006. And I had come back, it was Christmas, and I'd come back to London to go and see my sister, who lives in Lewisham. And it was a very, very busy pre-Christmas afternoon. And I was at Charing Cross, and I went to get on the train. And the train was absolutely packed, and I could barely find a seat. But I found one, let's say it's here. And everybody was stuffed in around me, but there was a lot of space around one person. It's kind of around there, a little bit diagonally away from me. And it was kind of obvious what was happening there, because this space, this seat, was occupied by a rough sleeper, somebody who smelled and who looked really rough, who had a beard and very matted hair and a number of cans of beer, was white, probably around 40. And there he was with his little empire, and nobody sat next to him. And so the train moved off. And at the next station, at London Bridge, someone else got on. And by this point, there was no room to sit whatsoever. And this person was the diametric opposite of the rough sleeper, but he had to sit opposite him. And when he sat down with his parcels and his shopping, because it was before Christmas and these were gifts, he took out his mobile phone and he started to make a phone call. And as he started to make that phone call, the rough sleeper, at least I assume that he was homeless, leant over to him and listened. And yet, the mobile phone man, the smartly dressed man, was not speaking in English. He was speaking in what I presume was an African language. He was tall, good-looking, black, and wearing a very smart suit. And the sleeper looked over at him and he said, as the man put the mobile phone away, he said, "That's my language too." And the mobile phone man just kind of like went, yeah, okay, mate, you know, visually, and just didn't say anything. And he said, my parents were missionaries in Africa. That's my first language. And the guy said absolutely nothing. We moved on the train, and it began to slow down at the next stop. And the guy with the mobile phone took up his smart bags, and he moved over to the door as the train began to pull into the station. And as he stood at the door, the other man spoke to him in the language they shared. And the moment he spoke to him in the language they shared, the mobile phone man put down his bags and he turned to him as the other man got up and they embraced. And their embrace was like brothers meeting after a war. It was like a mother meeting the child she hasn't seen for 50 years. They rubbed one another's arms, they laughed, they spoke in the language they shared. And within seconds it was over, because the doors opened. No phone numbers were exchanged, nothing happened at all. One man got off the train, and the other man went back to his corner with his cans. And at the next station, Lewisham, where I got off, I could see him absolutely slumped in his corner. I barely need to say what I began to think about that afterwards, about the turn of things, about the way that colonialism and skin and class and what it means to have a home actually resonate in different ways in the present. But what I was absolutely aware of was that I had just witnessed what it means to be absolutely homeless. That story resonates with me continuously. But it's not the same story. In every moment that I repeat that story, it becomes a very different kind of story. At the moment when it happened to me, I had my own problems with refuge and immigration. No one else on the train noticed what was happening at all. They all continued with what they were doing. Today, in the moment in which we are, in July 2016, notions of what it means to belong, what it means to speak the same language, what it means to be local, are very, very different. So that the story that happened in just the kind of immediate past resonates in a very, very different kind of way. The German philosopher Ernst Bloch said in 1932 that we do not all live in the same now. We don't live in the same space. We don't live in the same present, but somehow we are called to share it. And the work that I've been involved with and was involved in the video you can't see, which is, I don't actually quite know what it is, but it doesn't matter. It's kind of a shadowy ghost, if you like. And somewhere there is a shadowy ghost of myself there 30 years ago as well. But the work that I've been involved in and was then was around trying to create, particularly at this point, in the late 70s and very, very early 80s, was about making work cooperatively that was in some way invoking possibilities that we could not express. We talked about it then as making work for other people with dreams without means. We were all very involved, as been mentioned earlier on, in all kinds of community action in Leeds. There was Leeds Other Paper, there were bands, there was Suma Food Co-op, which actually started in our local food co-op in our street in Hyde Park Terrace. There were all kinds of ways in which that world was very profoundly interconnected. It was also, as Green has suggested, at the kind of utter fag end of a romantic bohemianism that we enjoyed because we could be absolutely reckless with it. We didn't really ever think about the future or think that we had it. But strangely enough, and oddly it goes back to something that Terry from Wising and I were talking about 10 minutes ago, one can never actually be very sure about the unintended consequences of what one does. Those unintended consequences, threads of connection that emerged from the values that we had then, continue to evolve and continue to resonate in the present that we have now. So that since I'm not making collective and collaborative performance anymore, I've continued to both write about it, and much more than that, to have it as a kind of watchword, as value within my own life and the way that I decided to live it. That's, in a way, one of the bits of conversation that I want to have. The process that we were involved in, and I'm going to bring in a very difficult word here, was actually, and I think Green talked about redemptive as well as transformative, and those are better words than spiritual. But there's also perhaps the imaginary that exists on the other side of what happens when you work together to have outcomes that you cannot possibly foresee. I think that that's a very interesting thing to be thinking about in uncertain times. Kevin and Green both talked about the ways in which we felt at the very end of the 1970s a profound disquiet about the certainties of left-wing politics. We felt absolutely sure that there were different ways of opening up the present and invoking almost prophetic ways in which the future might emerge. We could never have imagined the now then. But I also think we can't imagine the then now. The purpose of being here today to remember creatively in the sense of putting it together, almost as if it is a kind of, you know, loose organic body, is about actually useful ways in which the past can prompt us to think about the ways in which the values we hold to, and actually I think there must be many, many crossings of shared value in this room, that are also delivered and realized through multiple art projects. But that's the conversation. I want to end on the note conversation, because an ethicist, a philosopher in whom I'm very interested and have written about a bit, Kwame Anthony Appiah, talks about conversation as a much bigger word than the sense of being in a room and having a little dialogue. He talks about it in its 18th century sense of being about living together. And that the very notion of being able to converse, the very notion that we can be involved in a multifaceted way of exchanging together about our lives and lives that went before, about possible futures, about what we do. For me, that's one of the most useful dialogic tools that I learned from this extraordinary moment, which Kevin and Green evoked in a way which I found deeply moving and transformative myself. And I look forward to opening that conversation with all of you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that, Claire.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a privilege.
Chris. Hello. I'm going to speak, I think, much more prosaically than Claire just did. All I want to do, really, is introduce my work, because Gavin very kindly supposed that some of you might have seen it, but I'm going to suppose that none of you have. That feels like a more reliable point of embarkation for us. So I'll talk particularly about Pony Boy Curtis, which is the ensemble project that that I'm involved with currently. And I have a little sort of postscript, if I have time, just kind of thinking back towards some of the stuff that Green and Kevin were talking about before. So I started out as a playwright. I had my first, finished my first play and had my first professional production in 1994. And almost immediately I had a crisis about what it might mean to be a playwright. It felt like a very uncomfortable space to be in. For two reasons, I think. One of which is that I got into theatre because it felt like theatre was a social medium, and the individual model of the playwright, the romantic model of the playwright who sits in the garret mm-hmm. and projects something out of the heavens onto a piece of paper just felt utterly uncongenial and dull. So I started to worry about that. The other thing, the more interesting impetus, I suppose, at that point was noticing how inappropriate a container the script was for what I wanted to try and do, because right from the start I was much more influenced by music and by visual art and by experimental film than I was by other theatre and other performance that I was seeing. I was certainly in dialogue with, I suppose, artists like Derek Jarman or Michael Clarke or people like that. And the effect of that straight away was that my script looked incredibly unwieldy because they were mostly stage directions. I was trying to describe images and kinds of movement that it felt intrinsically ridiculous to try and be authoring as an individual. And so my practice took me straight away into the rehearsal room, into making work with performers and other creative people. I thought I'd sort of invented devising. I wasn't aware that anybody else worked like that. It was just, for me, an expeditious way of trying to make the work that I was interested in realising. And so we carried on in that way for a few years, and it became important to me quite quickly to have a company. Almost just as a sort of psychic landmark, having a company felt very important. And in 1999, I set up a company called Signal to Noise. The idea was that we would be a permanent collective. We started well. We started with a manifesto, as you must. And very quickly, things started to dwindle, mostly because of the economic pressures around the task of sustaining an ensemble, or carving out. I mean, none of us at that point were professional makers, so just trying to carve out some space in which to work together, or find physical space in which to work together. That's been a really ongoing narrative in my practice over the past 20-odd years. And so Signal to Noise, that ensemble that started with a group of seven of us in 1999, by 2002 I was doing my first solo show under that group name. That felt like that was the... there was some kind of... It was like there being a leak point in the inflatable. And within 3 years, that was all that we could support and muster. And in a sense, the rest of my career since then has been a sort of dialectical movement between the will to exist in an ensemble relationship with other makers and all of the pressures and forces that pull against that. In 2011, I started Chris Good & Company, which is really just a sort of structure, an administrative structure, a producing structure around the work that I was doing anyway as an independent artist. And Chris Good & Company still exists. We make three or four shows a year in a lot of different contexts and different ways. It's a group of three of us. So there's me and my producer and a critical writer, which is an unusual model. I'm not sure how prevalent it is, but that we have embedded right in the core of the company someone who writes critically about what we're doing. And that's been very interesting. But Chris Good & Company essentially is an idea in the form of a structure, and the structure is there to help me sustain my practice. And it was something that I'd been struggling towards for 15 years by the time the conversation about it started. And almost immediately, again, I was very bored with what it made possible. That I found myself almost straight away in a position of having access through my producer to a more reliable funding streams, to being able to produce the work that I was interested in making. It didn't become easy, but it did become possible, and I immediately started hankering again for the sorts of impossible things that that keep us awake at night and drive us on. It had been, I think, an idea in my head from about 2003 that what I really wanted was an ensemble that worked more like a band. And in particular, an ensemble that would meet regularly to make work together, regardless of whether it had the promise of an audience anyway down the line. That it would be something that we made for ourselves, that hopefully there would be outputs in front of audiences, but that we didn't care, that it became a practice that was for us, for our well-being, for our mental and emotional well-being. I don't mean that in a new agey, holistic-y sort of sense. I just mean we all know artists who go nuts if they can't do what they do, and that's we were just clinging together in that idea. So it took 11 years from I think the first time I described that ensemble to the moment of pushing go on it. It was because it felt impossible. It felt like the economic conditions, the practical and the logistical challenges around trying to create that ensemble were insuperable. And I think I got to a point, this is sort of halfway through 2014, of realising it was never going to get any easier. Never, ever, ever. And that if it was ever going to happen, I would just have to start. And so Pony Boy Curtis, which is the name of that ensemble, started with a week of research in December 2014. And since that point, we've been in a constant making process, which has included the making of three shows, but they're, in a sense, the least of it. We do meet twice a week, and I guess we're the best possible example that I can think of in my own practice of an intuition that I had very early on, which is that as an individual artist, you only ever get to make particular artworks, particular shows, particular products. If you're a company, part of what you get to make is the company. And I feel like that's what we're invested in doing, is we get together to make stuff, and part of what we're making when we do that is the company that we make it with. I wanted a company with longevity beyond the normal cycles of making an individual piece. I wanted a conversation with some people that continued way beyond that, for two reasons in particular, one of which was that I have a long-standing interest in creating performance structures that are semi-improvised, so where interlocking structures of permission and prompt allow a group of performers to work together in a genuinely live and a genuinely spontaneous active collective composition. So Gavin, for example, came to see a show we did recently at the Yard called Fuck Systems. If he had come, I don't know what night you came, Gavin, but if you'd come the night before or the night after, you'd have seen a different show. You'd have recognised the structure of it, the journey through it, but you'd have seen different things happen at every point. I'm very interested in that, but it's a kind of thing that's only possible in a group of people who know each other very well and who work with those techniques constantly. The other thing that's been a sort of impetus behind Pony Boy, and unfortunately the images that I hope to show of our work haven't transmitted properly through the ether, but you'd be seeing some examples of this right now. I'm very interested, and particularly in the last sort of 7 or 8 years, sort of fixatedly interested on how theatre and performance do sex and eroticism. And so Pony Boy Curtis is a site in which we push. I hear myself say push sometimes and I worry about it, but we're nudging at the normative boundaries around performance practice in that kind of space. And that again obviously is a kind of ask for performers and for other creatives as well, actually, and for audiences, that requires a structure that's... That's sort of infused with the kind of trust and fealty and sort of tribal entanglement that only comes from long periods of working together on those edges. So these are images from a performance called Coyote, who we did a few weeks ago. In fact, on the day after the referendum, which made it almost completely impossible to do anything. But that's what we did. So as far as I know, we're the first people ever put a blowjob on the stage of the new diorama. wear that with a certain amount of pride when in Rome. I want to say two things really quickly, if I may. I'm sure. Over time, but I just want to say a little something about the economic conditions in which we work and the what the industrial situation is at Ponyboy, because we don't, on the whole, pay ourselves to do what we do. If we did, we couldn't do it. It's a very uneasy position, I think, certainly for me, to keep asking people to work for free, but on the whole, that's what we do. We fund ourselves through a variety of different channels. Our sort of hardcore research work here, I don't mean hardcore as in, I mean hardcore as in it has no commercial appeal whatsoever. Research work is funded by the Arts Council, but our launch was funded by a crowdfunding campaign, and we now have some money on the table from a rich gay dude, almost inevitably. So we're having a conversation about how we feel about that. But on the whole, we don't pay each other, and that has two sort of interesting consequences, but interesting insofar as they shape the work. So one thing is that everybody tries to get together twice a week, but we say that if you have a job, a gig, whatever, that clashes with a Ponyboy meeting, and that's going to help you pay your rent, then you should prioritise that. And that means that we never know who's going to show up. And sometimes it will just be me and one person or two people. And this constant shift in what the shape of the company is because of the economic pressures that keep pulling us away from the work, from the place of the work, has shaped what the work is. It's shaped what those relationships, how we look at those relationships and what the kinds of relationships are that we feel accepting of. The idea that you have to be there in order to be part of the conversation is much more unstable than I think it would be in the rest of my work. The other thing that I think it's important to say is that we have a situation now where we are paid when we need to be. So there's a little bit of money in the company, and people who need to be paid for the work that they do with the company can ask to be paid. Mm-hmm. And that's something that the company again then administers. And again, pretty obviously, that requires a certain kind of set of relationships to be at work in the work that makes it not only permissible but desirable that different people are paid different amounts at different times for doing the same work according to the need that they might be in the moment that they're doing it. It feels like a really important part of our ethos. The last thing I wanted to say was just to make a quick connection back to the last session. I was thinking about the sort of scrappy energy that Ponyboy represents, and the model that I always reach for is the one of being a band and wanting that kind of relationship with the work and with our audiences. But I've been really prompted to notice how much my sense of what we do is also shaped by the experience that I had, particularly early on in my career, from an involvement in the experimental poetry scene in London. So Jeff Nuttall, who Green spoke about, his tutor in Leeds, I got to meet on that scene towards the end of his life. He was certainly a formidable person. And that was a group of, that still is a group of people who are absolutely fixated on a particular mode of production in which almost nobody has any interest. And the ferocity with which they pursue it has always been very, very inspiring to me. So the first theatre text that I had published was published by a tiny independent poetry publisher called Bark. And the only time I ever saw that chapbook on a bookshelf was at Compendium, shortly before it closed. And it feels important to sort of mention those connections, because I know we've got a kind of a now and then thing going on, and it feels really important that there was also a middle ground where those things were, you know, were giving way to new things. And my attachment to the kind of scene that was around, that was kind of in its, that was maybe just unravelling that had stubbornly persisted through to the end of the 80s or the beginning of the 90s. My attachment to those residual parts of the scene feels like a place where I learned a lot to do a lot of the things that I now do, for example, mm-hmm. with Pony Boy. Mm-hmm. I think I'm done. I think that's it. Thank you.
Fantastically rich, and I'm not going to say very much because I want to get other people's voices in, but I do want to kind of take some of the things that you were saying there about the scrappy energy, was that the phrase you used, of being in a band, and so also some of the economic pressures that impose upon being in an ensemble, and ask Claire to say a little bit about that, because I should say that part of my book is on Impact Theatre, so I've interviewed a number of its founding members, and Tyrone Huggins, another member of Impact from the time, recalls being in Impact as feeling like basically living out of each other's pockets, which is a kind of economic rationalisation of the group, if you will. And I wonder if you could just say a little bit about that, Claire, about how you sustained the practice of Impact, especially in the very early years.
I think many of the things that Chris and other people have said, of course, absolutely resonate with me. So being in a band, I think, is one of those kind of cultural icons that we all understand. And I think that sense of being bound together, having a sense of doing things as a kind of collective authorship that wasn't about one person and was about much more than we could make, was absolutely true. There was also a lot of crossover with bands as well. So Steve Shill was in Sheeny and the Goys, and Hugo Burnham, who's in the Gunner 4, was in Impact at the beginning, and then worked with Pete Brooks, the director of Impact, much later as well. So I think this is a very sort of interpolated kind of culture. How we sustained that, and I'm listening to Chris and thinking how many things are very common, even to that moment between the late 70s and the 80s, and things are changing all the time. I don't think there was a kind of... I'm not sure about the persistence of a scene or a culture. I just think it's constantly shifting and changing. How did we sustain it? Well, I think, first of all, we sustained it because I think there wasn't a sense of future. I think there was a sense of only being now. I don't think there was a future that we could have imagined. We all always worked at other jobs. I think there was, and it's been described earlier on today, a sort of imaginative seriousness about what we did, because I think the one thing that's perhaps changed very much in the culture and perhaps worth really talking about is whose voices are allowed to be, are really kind of enabled within the culture. So I think that in the sense there was a big alternative culture that was enabling many, many voices to be part of it then. You mean financially, though, economically?
Yeah, I do, yes.
Well, a couple of really big things. I think we were absolutely a collaborative, a collective. We pooled our money most of the time. But I think we were very, very well aware that as people from working class and low middle class backgrounds, that by doing that, we had access to the kinds of things that... I mean, access being another very, very important contemporary keyword, that we had access to other countries, to the kinds of food, to other people, to artists, to all sorts of things that we had. We also paid for childcare. It's very important. I mean, we come from a generation in which we had children, and we took those children on tour with us all the time as well. And we encouraged other people who had children to join us and work with all kinds, lots and lots of musicians. We were definitely maintained by the benefit system.
I mean, Tyrone told me a very interesting story. I presume it's true.
Yeah.
That in the early years of Thatcher's enterprise allowance, which was available to individual entrepreneurs, that being in a group formation meant you could actually apply for it more than once.
Yeah,
because there were multiple individuals in that group, and then
Like lots of people, we were definitely, and we also had lots of other parts of our jobs.
Play the system a bit.
Well.
Yeah.
You know, we did all the other things that people do. We probably did play the system a bit, but I think we had a tremendous kind of commitment towards sustainability. We never did have I think it was a much later moment at which the Arts Council created things like, I don't know what they're called, like national, I don't know, are they called NPOs or NOPs or something? Mm-hmm. We never had any sustained funding. And in fact, I think, thinking back to what Kevin and Green were saying as well, we felt a tremendous sense of isolation. I mean, I'm looking at Kevin and I know that we're giving the impression of a very, very extraordinary culture. But one of the things that happened in art schools then was it wasn't people like us who were teaching us. We were the generation that went on to teach other people who've become the people who've created other things later. Many of the people like Jeff Nuttall and John Fox at Leeds were dropouts from Oxford. They weren't people who'd been educated, didn't come from state schools. They weren't part of the kind of world that we had at all. Mainstream was completely uninterested in us. There was no critical interest in what we did whatsoever. And the film I was going to show, I think, was when we finally went to Italy in our van and spent 3 months in an old school eating school dinners because we couldn't even get anywhere to rehearse in Leeds. Our Arts Council reports were so bad that we would often be taken aside and told that there would simply be no more funding for us. And it was partly that we were involved in this redemptive, transformative, semi-spiritual, prophetic kind of work, which did not meet highly materialist, very, very, very reductive economic left-wing politics at the time. And that doesn't mean we weren't radical, it just means we were absolutely somewhere else entirely. That's just way off the subject. But, you know.
Can I pick up on something that you said, Claire? I mean, I was very taken with the Block quote that
yeah,
that you
I know,
used.
I like that quote, 1932.
But you also said something quite interesting. You said about the working in a collective allowed you to kind of, I don't know if these were your words,
yeah,
but
sure,
to kind of struggle towards possibilities that A, you could not express,
yes,
and B, that you could never be sure what the intended consequences were going to be of whatever it is you were going to produce. I mean, do they ring true for you, Chris, as well, in terms of your work? And is there something that particular about collaborative, collective creation, as opposed to, let's say, an individual pursuit, which makes it less, makes one less able to predict, if you like, what might unfold.
Yeah, I mean, we have an attachment in Ponyboy, certainly, to very unpredictable to work that emerges from the
exactly,
interlocking of a bunch of different systems. So whatever happens, particularly in front of an audience, is often totally unpredictable.
Yeah.
And it feels very important that those things sit in relation to an audience at a particular time,
yeah,
in a particular place, that we're trying to, you know, that even with Coyote, trying to do that piece the day after the referendum, you know, on that Friday when everyone was feeling so fucking awful, it was to know that we had the possibility of making something happen that night that could be, in a sense, relevant to how people were feeling, or which we couldn't have done if we'd had a piece on tour. So that certainly resonates. Having said that, I think, again, particularly with Ponyboy, we have a very clear sense of a kind of relationship that we're seeking to establish with an audience, which is probably best... our work was described by an early reviewer who called Ponyboy an experimental performance boy band. Mm. And that sort of nails something about the kind of relationship that we're trying to establish with an audience. And in a sense, there's a real... there's a kind of a reckless abandon behind what we do, despite the fact that it's also very carefully controlled within all of those systems that I'm not quite describing. But we're also making, I think, trying to make a very energised and sort of attitudinous appeal to an audience. So it feels very, I think performing with Ponyboy feels a lot like performing a musical. Do you know what I mean? It has that sort of that eye line that's energised and dynamic and seductive, and so in a sense we have a very clear intent around our work. We're just not sure how we'll get there.
Mm-hmm.
But we had some very interesting conversations in making the work this year, the piece that you saw, Fuck Systems, because we had sort of difficult second album syndrome a little bit, because we got to a point where we were able to have much more complex and sophisticated conversations about what it was that we were doing together, which meant that we had much better but much more intractable arguments about what it was that we're doing. And there was a really interesting conversation about whether it was permissible as Ponyboy for our doubt and our conflictedness to be part of what we presented on stage, or whether that was something that we tried to resolve in the rehearsal room in order to be able to present this kind of, this very appealing, energised, sort of single-minded quasi-boy band experience that's so visceral and so clear in some of its intentions. So I think, I mean, in a sense, you're describing something that's a really big conversation for us.
Yes, Claire.
Very, very, very quickly.
People have questions. Yeah. We'll be coming to you soon.
Ever so quickly, I think there's, in a sense, even individual artists are also collaborating. There's a sense in which you're profoundly informed by the work around you. So we were very informed by systems music, by all kinds of music, actually, by structuralism, by narrative film, by all kinds of artists that were around. But there's a big difference, I think, between art in which you're setting up the conditions under which meaning can emerge, and many kinds of things go into that: kinetic, visual, sonic, and even textual, and they might all have a kind of equivalence, and lots of that comes out of an earlier generation of artists, Cage and Cunningham, Rauschenberg, all kinds of people like that, and art in which there's a determined sense of following a kind of narrative, and I think Impact's work was the first. It's to do with setting up all kinds of conditions, some of them quite odd, some of them almost psychotropic, actually, and then seeing what happens out of that. So you're evolving a way to live in a completely alternate imaginary world, and then whatever happens on stage is part of that imaginary, imaginative, alter world.
Yes, we've got a question there.
It seems like what both of you are describing is a sort of rejection of the traditional hierarchical relationship that exists in creating theatre. But to what extent, I mean, and Chris, you talked about the part of what you're creating is the group that you're creating it with. But to what extent do you ever feel that you can successfully eliminate the primacy of one creative voice in that collaborative process?
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Is it still Chris Good's Ponyboy?
I mean, it is, and that's something that the boys are properly cross about, and I understand why. And it's not something. I mean, it's something I suppose what I mean is that's something that happens at the level of kind of marketing and publicity and criticism, that my name gets attached sort of above the title or whatever in a way that feels absolutely sort of that again yanks us back to a model that we've never wanted to engage with, and I don't know quite how we climb out of that. I think something that's nice about Ponyboy is that we've worked very little with text, and so we are either all writers or none of us are writers, and that immediately alleviates some of the syntax that we're used to, and that still obtains in some of the places that I work with Chris Good and Company, about whose singular vision is being served. That's not a place I like to work at all. But those residues are certainly present, even just as bodily aversions, allergies in the room. Those things are still there.
And is that in some way a bit like what you were saying, Claire, about how the Arts Council didn't understand what you were doing, or the mainstream didn't understand it, so they can only see it through the prism that it understands?
Not really. I mean, I think that the zeitgeist was very, very different in the 1980s, and I think there was an enormous and very proper concern with issues from the left that needed to be explored, and those had unexpected consequences too. Many things came out of that. It wasn't a rejection of it. It was just the only thing we knew how to do, and it was fed by our own interests in art, music, film, and other things. It just wasn't. And also, how we were living was entirely well, not entirely, but the kind of cooperatively based. I've worked a lot with directors since then, but I think theatre's profoundly changed. I don't think it is based anymore around that model. There are so many multiple models.
Really depends where you are, though.
Yeah, of course it depends, but that's what I'm saying. There are multiple models, and it depends who you are, where you are, and what now you're in, what space you're in, you know, all kinds of different things. But the model has been absolutely exploded, I think, a long time ago.
I think it... I would say it persists. I mean, I...
Of course it persists.
I think there is a central model that
but
we all define ourselves...
But we attend to the persistence. We attend... Well, I'm not sure, because that's a model of centre and margins that I also don't really agree with. I think we attend to the persistence rather than honouring the scattering and the multiplicity of alternatives. And that's something I've always wanted to do.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. But I think my experience of working in particular industrial situations is that that model is still absolutely central.
Yeah,
and that we still are required to define ourselves in relation to it.
Mm-hmm. Not least economics.
That's
what right, Chris.
Transfunding and
Other voices? On the right-hand side of the room, the right brain? No?
What I want to say...
Screen.
Green.
A quick
stand
thought,
up.
Collective endeavours are often short-lived and there's nothing wrong with that.
No, you're right.
There's a lot of tension, there's a lot of explosive, there's a lot of personal stuff, a lot of political stuff.
I don't need a monkey.
You might need it.
And that's possibly even a good thing, that these things burn out quickly, that there's an intensity of other people move on to other things. I also don't think there's anything wrong in a collective group with a division of labour. I mean, it doesn't matter. There's one of you in the room that can do, even if the spotlight's on you, you know, you're the one with the voice or whatever, then that's fine, you know, I'll do something.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? It doesn't have to, we don't all, there doesn't have to be the same voice or the same role.
I would say something about friendship.
Also very important, that what you said about centres and margins, I think that spatial metaphor is not a good...
No, and I think I misrepresented Chris. But I wanted just to enter something into the conversation about friendship. Because, I mean, one of the things that we're sort of getting towards here is that collectives are collectives about process and making, but they're also collectives which are, and cooperative workings and partnerships and DIY now too, about what basically was the kind of queering of culture that happened in the 80s. So they were about addressing very, very other kinds of hierarchies around the bourgeois family, around patriarchy, around our sexuality, the way that we were allowed to have children or not have children and to bring them up. And when I worked a little bit on Cage and Cunningham, the poet Robert Creeley once said that collaboration shortened the distance between he and I, and it enabled a process of hand-to-hand collaboration that enabled lifelong friendship. And I think that sense of honouring friendship amongst people, I mean, and those people are still my closest friends in Impact. But I think that friendship is a very, very underrated social structure, that those of us who always felt isolated from mainstream structures have been able to build. And I think it can help us now. I think it's really important, and then it has a real material presence in the world for us that we need to hang on to.
So this persists after the band has split, basically, is what you're saying.
Well,
right?
We didn't speak to one another. I mean, there are people I didn't speak to for, I mean, a long time. But that's life, you know. That's just the way things go.
I mean, the great exception to the rule about bands splitting up, of course, is the Mekons. They're still going on, still going strong. Nearly 30 years after. I mean, there's been many different many different membership. But they're still going strong, right?
I think that is interesting talk about hierarchies, which isn't quite how I would characterise it, but it's, first of all, there's a truism that anybody who says they want to work collectively or think it's a good idea has never done it.
Absolutely.
it creates a framework and context in which you work, but within that, it can be very fluid. And people will emerge, like Regan said, over periods of time,
But it does allow permeability and allow roles to be more fluid and allow people to find spaces for themselves and surprise each other. But it doesn't create an utter equality.
No.
It's not about equality, really, is it?
But it does allow a more fluid situation where people don't get entrenched, as in the hierarchy, which is why I think I'm not quite comfortable with that word. But it does allow certain people to run with the ball for a while and somebody else take a breather and somebody else come forward. So it, as a process, it's very nurturing.
Yeah.
But as you said as well, Green, it can be very difficult at times as well. And working collectively doesn't just have to happen with music or with theatre. We've done two collective major art shows. Mm. And there was a big difference between the two of them. And the first one was when we were all doing our own practice and kind of brought it together and kind of shoved it into the same box, and it was a disaster. And we kind of had to remind ourselves that that's not how you work collectively. The second one we came with sets of ideas, which we discussed, and then started to generate work, and that made a much more coherent, much more interesting project. When we remembered that that's what you do when you work collaboratively, you leave a bit of yourself behind in order to allow more things to emerge.
Do you think there's now more self-consciousness about the difficulties of working collectively, given that we've had so many decades you know, kind of radical collectivist practice in one field or another, and so we're more conscious of the limitations and the kind of you know, stumbling blocks and all the rest of it? Or do you think we're just as much in the dark as perhaps once were, Claire?
I don't know. Sorry about that. I think it's shifted. And when I was writing this chapter in this book, you know, it's moved and morphed. And I think the words now, collaboration was not a word that we would have used. We're still tainted with a post-war kind of feeling anyway. We were anarcho-syndicalists working cooperatively. But I think now partnership, collaboration, collaborative working and dialogue are very much part of a wider sense of culture. They've also been bought, by the way. They've been bought. So there's a way in which a resistant kind of sense of what dialogue and conversation can be is really needs to be nourished. Mm. And ways to nourish that, tools to nourish that, I think, are what we want to be able to have.
Mm. Chris, you got an interest?
Just to make a point sort of adjacent to that, really, which is fascinating to me and a little bit scary, which is the way in which devising has become the central model for performance education.
Yeah, that's right.
So most students undertaking a performance or a theatre degree that's in any sense experimental, their principal experience will be of working collectively.
That's because we taught them. It doesn't become. It's because we taught them to do it.
But what's interesting is how that then establishes a series of orthodoxies around methodology and around the sort of the implied politics of that. I suspect the actual politics of it don't get discussed much, or they're taken as though they were manifest. Mm. But it would be very interesting to see how those people graduating from those courses continue to enter the sector, how things will shift, and whether there will be, I'm really hoping for, devising's punk moment that comes along and explodes those orthodoxies and reminds us that something other than that brought us to the room in the first place.
Donna, are you...
I thought I was going to say something about this, that you might have a bit of a tangent which might not be that helpful at this stage, but... It might be really interesting to hear from some people who've been through art school recently whether you're also recognising this in terms of like the legacy of the 70s now being the people who are teaching people who are going through art school now. From what you've just said, Chris, is not what I think is happening in the visual arts in terms of how it's being taught, or certainly wasn't up until quite recently, probably, because the structures are completely different, you know, in terms of this kind of relationship to the market, for example, you know, and how an individual practice through some of the major art colleges have been incredibly focused on the market as the goal, you know, bringing your individual concept to market and somehow selling it. So the way that you're talking about theatre being taught is kind of the opposite to how the visual arts have been taught.
I think one of the things is that to think that collaboration is a lens rather than an element of education, if you like. So individual artists can have many forms of collaborative practice, conversational practice, working together. Do you see what I mean? I think one of the ways to think about it is that it's not as if we kind of shift from a moment in which everything's devising and then you can make the content of it collaboration. But if you think about it as a lens through which we might look at the culture, then the practice even of artists in the then looks really different. Do you see what I mean? I mean, it's we look at that whole notion of what it means to be collaborative, then it's everything from the one-to-one, the collaboration with the past, to many other kinds of things, and it allows us to see it rather differently, even in a very market-orientated culture, and perhaps to draw out from it the things that nourish future possibility.
No, I think the visual arts is coming out of that now, and the person I was hoping might say something is just put her hand up.
Was Erica? Ironically.
I didn't do a practice-based art degree. But one of the things that I've thought about a lot in terms of working collaboratively or with other people in my own practice, which I do, is because of my interest in kind of digital labour and all of the infrastructures around that, I often find myself coming up against this. It is basically a question around authorship, but the way that that relates to things like crowdfunding and the role of kind of collaboration in even things like Amazon, where, you know, Or things that the users contribute to. They're also the producers of the content. And sometimes as an artist, if you're kind of drawing on some of these structures where you're getting other people to contribute or drawing on other people's opinions in some way, there's so much thought has to go into what the pay structure is, what is the dynamic, what is the hierarchy of the artist to these others, if because of the way that the art market is, you can't put everybody's name on the bill, or at most you might be able to get a couple of other people's names. So then, are you just, it's that question of, are you then just replicating those infrastructures by which big corporations like Amazon get lots of other people to do work for them for their own profit? And so that, you know, that tension between not really wanting to work on your own, but at the same time, the issues that collaboration in light of kind of digital labour bring up is something I've found quite difficult anyway.
Totally. Does anybody want to say anything to that? Is it you and me, Bomb Bomb Train, who's been in trouble over that?
Have they?
Yeah.
But then collaboration becomes a question. I mean, I think it's partly about what educative practices, autodidactic or others, enable us to be able to turn situations into useful questions, which is partly what your work continuously addresses. How might I turn this into a situation in which it can be exposed, in which we can work with it? And isn't that what art does? This constant fluid kind of turning from the material to what lies beyond it in order to do that. Which is not to say that those are not extremely important economic questions for artists as well. Sorry, Chris.
No.
Do we have?
But I'd like to hear about other people's experiences actually in terms of either going to art school. I mean, that's one thing, but also just in terms of. The terms that I'm hearing, transform is one, transition is another, even change itself, movement. What are the kind of the terms that are operating to unpick things that we're touching on, that become contested in the culture that we're in now, that are relevant to what we're talking about? Anybody? Somebody there? Charlotte, Charlotte, tell us. Well, one word, if you were to say the kind of couple of words of the moment, what would it be? Yeah.
I just think we're missing what I think is really important about collectives is that it's an anti-capitalist notion. Like, if we're talking about the individual as an artist in art school, making themselves marketable, the whole point of a collective to me is that it's skill sharing.
Do you want to claim it for anti-capitalism? Do you want to claim the collective for anti-capitalism?
I mean, it's for people's interpretation, but... Like,
well, you can't say both those things. You can't claim it and then say it's open to interpretation.
I mean, I don't know. What do you think?
But I absolutely, it's really important, the anti-capitalist thing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we use that word. I was just thinking that as we were talking about this. I was like, oh, what, you know, but that's because it's, like, recognisable to people. And I don't know, like, I don't think, yeah. I can totally see the neoliberal.
Go on, Charlotte,
thing,
put the microphone up and okay. Say it. It's great what you're saying.
but I just, yeah, like, I've lost my train of thought. Just that... Yeah, I think it's just being understandable to a lot of people, and that is like reference. Yeah, that is in like radical sort of culture that is still used as a reference point.
About free schools and
absolutely.
About higher education is beyond the means of the working class generally in this country. Mm-hmm. Their collective working means that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, collective working just opens the doors for people to learn from each other.
Absolutely.
And I think that especially goes against the state quite often as well. And the way that we're made to kind of fight against each other within capitalism. Right. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've got a comment or question.
Yeah,
I just think this is a really, really important issue. I'm at Cambridge School of Art at the moment. And I'm actually speaking here next week as part of the sustainability with Cambridge. And one of the first things we're starting with, and one of the first points that we thought that we would embark on, is skill sharing. Mm-hmm. And just continuing that social aspect of what we can learn from each other.
Yes.
And any kind of capitalist view just doesn't come into it at all. And I feel really lucky to be a part of something like that. And I feel that in a great many institutions, that's at threat of being lost in the economic climate that we're in at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm. It's a really good one. Other people, that sense that capitalism itself, I didn't even say that was a key word now, but is under pressure. But is it our responsibility, and I was being, saying claim it, to really put it under pressure? And what does that mean? What tools do we have to put it under pressure that are not reductive tools? They're not the tools of a kind of old left that says, actually, it all comes down to economics. We know that culture in itself is a... And I know you're not doing that. I'm being devil's advocate. But that it's that actually we can put it... How do we put it under pressure? You two are putting it under pressure. But that's a really important thing for us to think about.
And then we've got somebody...
Yeah, carry on.
I'm not sure if this is just going to come out in a splurge of words. Okay. I was just thinking that I'm doing fine art at the moment at Falmouth, and I'm also in a dance theatre performance company. And it's really interesting to compare the two and how the art school, the art degree structure is very much... now confined by the fact it's a business, and it's and everything is to do with kind of this individualistic approach to moving towards a career and money making, and as opposed to the performance group that I'm in, which is very much collaborative, not to do with money, not to do completely outside of that world. And it's really, I think that's the most valuable thing about it, is the fact that it is a collaboration. And what you were saying about how do we work against how do we kind of change capitalism, I think the thing that's most fundamentally problematic in our society alongside that is the lack of empathy. And I think the key thing in collaboration is that it increases our empathy. And that was the main thing that I took away from my experience in a collaborative group, is empathy and the kind of infinite possibilities of creativity that come from that. So.
This is quite interesting, listening to that from a student that's... was studying at Falmouth, because I did another MA at Falmouth 10 years ago, and the culture within how the political framework has changed in 10 years from a university, studying fine art in that university, we were given so much free will, given so much space, and now the same MA, the same degree, is completely commercially driven. And it's a shame because the experience has lessened a great deal over that 10 years.
So we're going to ask all the artists who've made enormous amounts of money of my generation, seriously. When I first went to Leeds in 1971, I was 16, and there was a very important, and I can't remember the name of it now, collective, which was about taking the money, people offering money from previous generations to fund the projects of our generation. And so where are we? I mean, there is an enormous amount of capital floating around in the art world. Where are we going to access the nourishing financial means with the trust that we and faith that we might want to have to take on those next projects? Is it that we have to do it ourselves, or do we continue to ask it of the state?
Which is, was a collaborative, it was one of the first ones in London, so I was taught by him and it was pretty rad.
I didn't hear any of that. Can you say it again? Put the, yeah.
Hey.
You need to go to a what? Go on.
You need to go to a different school. Well, I think it's just a variety of schools that you need to go to, just because I was taught, well, I went to Westminster and I was taught by Peter Owen and he set up City Racing, and that was, yeah, he was really influential in the terms of like collaboratives and working together and that, this, that, and that. And then I went to Royal College, and then Baseman took over from Wentworth sculpture, and he brought in a different perspective again. Like, no one got, like, there's a few guys got picked up from the for the galleries and shit like that, but nobody really wants to get picked up anymore, not from like Royal College. It's more about the art for itself, like the truth, like that value, like the stoniness of the stone, man.
Nothing better than those incredible transformative individuals who can really change you in education, is there? And to name them is part of honouring that tradition. So Richard Wentworth is one, and who's the other one?
No, it wasn't Richard Wentworth, man. It was Jordan Baseman.
He's gone. I can hear.
Baseman. Baseman took over on Peter Owen.
Okay.
Yeah.
Both of you went to...
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and where did Peter? Where did Peter Owen go to college? Anybody know?
No idea.
He was with Paul Noble. He was those guys.
Yeah.
But City Racing is a really important gallery in London that happened in the early 90s.
Yeah.
And but again, it came out of a position of anger, and also taking the piss out of the art world.
Yeah.
Which in a way is what the whole punk thing was about as well.
Yeah.
There was an anger there. So in a way, I feel like we need to be angry again and, you know, take a position. And I think starting your own collectives and working together is the only way. We can't rely on the state anymore.
It's also over generation to generation, hand to hand, isn't it? Brilliant. Somebody else, come on.
Well, we're
no,
out
we're
of
out.
Time.
Sorry, Gavin, I'm taking
a chance.
There's one more at the back,
more.
Definitely.
Yeah.
At least one more at the back.
Here,
go on.
I think there's an increasing issue with the word sustainability. It's become part of the rhetoric of arts funding,
yeah.
Arts organisations. Actually doing things which are unsustainable is a lot more radical, a lot more energising, a lot more interesting. Things can live in a moment and be mm-hmm. quite special. And they might go on to become, you know, some might go on to have a longer life. But if we're completely bound by issues of sustainability constantly, then this is just deadening, absolutely deadening.
That's interesting. Well, we have no more time, I'm afraid. So let's thank our panellists.